Thanks. So it's a pleasure to speak about this here, and it's been a great workshop so far. So what I'm going to tell you about is some work I have done and some work that's been sort of done by various people over the last year on trying to extend the ADS-CFT correspondence to understand systems with slightly different global symmetries, in particular systems with non-relativistic symmetries. And sort of I'm going to broadly break up the talk into a while talking about some motivation why we ought to be thinking about this topic at the first place. Then I'll spend some time reviewing what I will call Galilean conformal algebras, just from sort of an algebraic point of view, to see what kind of structures there are and what constraints we get. And then we'll take a first pass at holography, where I'll sort of review the basic strategy of how we could go about constructing holographic duals. With just the knowledge of the symmetries. Okay, so without assuming where they come from, we'll just write down a bunch of metrics, see they satisfy some obvious symmetry properties, and try to see whether they are sort of the right kind of thing. But then, to make things more precise, then I will try to realize this in string theory. I'll try to convince you that these can be naturally embedded in string theory and obtained as field theories living on brains. Slightly strange field theories, but they are nevertheless in the usual brain engineered kind. And then, time permitting, I will talk a bit about some thermodynamics. And hydrodynamics of these theories engineered in string theory, which and why we discuss that will become clear from when I discuss the motivation. And I'll end with some general comments about why we should, what this teaches us and what we should be trying to do in the future. Okay, so let's begin with some motivation. So the simplest motivation I can give is that we've had the ADS-CFT correspondence around for a decade, and in some sense we know that it sort of provides a classical master field for a class of large n gauge theories. It gives us a master field for these large n gauge theories in terms of classical gravity in some higher dimensional space. The question is, does there exist a similar classical gravitational master field for other strongly coupled field theories? And here, I'm really interested in sort of a description where classical gravity is good. We could sort of generalize this notion and ask whether whether there's a string theory dual to some strongly coupled system. And one reason to be interested in this question, beyond sort of the standard gauge field theories which are relevant for QCD type dynamics, is that there are other systems. We've seen in the case of ADS-QCD that ADS-CFT has provided us with a nice framework to compute certain quantities which have perhaps direct quantitative evidence, quantitative relevance in the case of QCD, the famous example being sort of the ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density for Korg-Gluon plasma. Which we'll hear more about in Rob's talk later this afternoon. But is this sort of, does this exhaust the class of strongly coupled systems that, that we can talk about? Are there other strongly coupled systems? Are there other diagnostics like E over S that, that we might be able to compute in other strongly coupled theories? And over the last few years, we've seen that ADS-CFT has sort of taken on a much bigger role. People have tried applying ADS-CFT-based ideas to discuss various other systems, notably coming from condensed matter like superconductivity, superfluidity, talking about quantum critical points. And in this realm of things, the sort of non-relativistic conformal field theories that I'll describe sort of naturally fit into this paradigm. So before we go on, so there's a sort of philosophical comment about what this means. So despite intense work for a decade, we still don't really understand sort of the nuts and bolts of holography. We don't know, in principle, if you're handed a strongly coupled system, we don't know how to reverse engineer and construct this gravitational master field. We can sort of work backwards. We can try to sort of posit some metric, some symmetries, and try to see what follows from there. But we still don't know what the exact gravitational dual is for a given strongly coupled system. We don't know how to construct that from first principles. And in what I say, there's another important caveat. The kinds of field theories I'll be describing, or the kinds of field theories you'd like to apply this philosophy to, are ones where there's no natural large N limit. Okay, so we'll be talking about field theories sort of built up from fermions with some tuned interaction. So this sort of, at best, you can sort of try to cook up vector-like models. You're not going to be able to cook up non-abelian gauge symmetries. Whereas the holographic systems that I'm going to talk about will naturally come equipped with non-abelian gauge symmetries. Okay. So that's one sort of motivation that we might sort of be interested in sort of constructing more holograms. But there's sort of a flip side, and something that we ought to keep in mind when we construct holograms is that this endeavor is also likely to provide us some insight into aspects of quantum gravity. Now, if we had a hologram for some strongly coupled field theory, we could use that strongly coupled field theory as a non-perturbative description of gravitational dynamics in a class of spacetimes, and therefore we'd have some idea of what quantum gravity in this class of spacetimes is doing. So, of course, for the case of ADS-CFT, we know that some class of gauge theories provides us as is the hologram for quantum gravity in asymptotically ADS spacetimes. And there are sort of interesting asymptotics, like asymptotically flat or asymptotically de-Sitter, that we would really like to understand in great quantitative detail. What we'll see is that we're not going to get anywhere near that in this talk, but we'll see that there'll be spacetimes with strange asymptotics. And causal structures that naturally emerge in this game. And if we believe our holographic dictionary in this case, we would conclude that despite sort of the inherent strangeness in the gravitational theory, we'd nevertheless have a well-defined quantum gravity in these spacetimes. And then there's a sort of third reason why I find this fascinating. It's sort of the general exploration of non-relativistic systems. And here, there are two sort of main reasons. One is sort of experimental in the context of cold atom system, which I'll talk about shortly. And another, which is my personal favorite, is to try to understand non-relativistic hydrodynamics. And here I in particular mean the structure of Navier-Stokes equations for incompressible fluid flow, which has been a long-standing problem in mathematical physics for over a century. In particular, that's one of the issues that sort of I think we could tackle in this framework. So I'm not going to answer the question how we're going to be able to tackle it, but that's one of the hopes in this game. So I'll come back to this experimental realization in a moment, but in this context, let me mention that sort of over the last few years, we've seen sort of a well-developed notion of how hydrodynamics can emerge for any sort of interacting quantum field theory. We've seen this from the very beginning in ADS QCD. And we've sort of developed a nice dictionary of how to relate sort of arbitrary fluid flows to particular gravitational solutions in the context of theories with relativistic conformal invariance. And that, if we could extend to theories with non-relativistic symmetry, we'd naturally be sort of talking about the dynamics of Navier-Stokes equations. And mapping the dynamics of Navier-Stokes equations into dynamics of gravity might give you some insight into how the system behaves, just in terms of PDEs. And if you're trying to sort of prove some global regularity issues, the mapping might prove useful to get a better insight.
Are you talking about classical hydrodynamics
here? I'm talking about classical hydrodynamics here. So the precise context I'll sort of make clear towards the later part of the talk. But what I'm thinking about here is you take some interacting quantum field theory. So in some long wavelength limit, when sort of the system reaches local equilibrium, I can talk about the system in some hydrodynamic description. The parameters that enter the hydrodynamics are functions of the coupling. But they're just some parameters, like what the energy density is or what the shear viscosity is and so on. But given that map, if my strongly coupled field theory has a gravitational dual, this hydrodynamic limit also ought to have a gravitational dual. So we can map this problem of studying some fluid flow in the field theory to the dynamics of some kind of, at least we were able to show this in a restricted context, to dynamics of black holes in some class spacetimes. So the same thing ought to be true here, and I'll argue how it will be true in the later part of the talk. Any other questions so far? Okay. So the reason this whole thing got started is, of course, due to the experimental system of cold atoms, where it's believed that these systems provide an example of a non-trivial, strongly coupled, non-relativistic conformal field theory. So the system is very simple. It's just a bunch of lithium atoms. At what's called a Fishbach resonance. So you tune the interaction between the fermions so that you achieve a bound state at threshold. The system stays non-relativistic because it's just some atomic system, but you achieve scale invariance. So the quantitative way to think about this is to think about the S-wave scattering length. And the S-wave scattering length is tuned off to infinity in the scale invariant limit.
So indeed.
So as I disclaimed myself a short while ago, but this is the motivation.
Okay. Was QCD qualifying as the? Oh yeah, I mean, what's in here? Is it one? Is it five?
So if you ask me what the dual of this theory is, I would say at best it can be some string theory. Okay, so it's not going to be classical gravity in some space-time processing, which I'm going to describe. the aim of the game so far is to sort of identify the symmetries here and write down some geometry that sort of respects the symmetries and see how far we can get.
Let me ask a question this way. Yeah. Is there some possibility that if instead of just using lithium, you used lithium and seven other elements in the same column periodic table and put them all together, you can make something that is more like large N, or does it not work that way?
No. So I don't have any large N model that works with with N squared degrees of freedom. You can sort of write down toy models where you have vector-like models here. But we already know that... Well, okay, so we know that vector-like models like ON model are not described by ordinary gravity in ADS. They're described by some sort of higher spin gravity, some interacting Fredkin-Vasiliev type theories.
But look, QCD has only three colors, right? We can still talk about N. But at least it's three. I mean, there's some other three.
It
just seems like one of the interesting things about this is it's a place where you could do controlled experiments if you
yes.
can find a system that actually...
Yes, it's a much cleaner... Indeed. So it's a much cleaner system than the quark gluon plasma because there's much more finer control on the system. But
you see, you cannot find an experimental system with four colors.
But I could probably in condensed matter systems, I could imagine rigging something up like this with the right finding the right kind of metal or set it out or what have you. I don't know. It just seems like
okay.
So has anyone thought about that at all?
I think that's an interesting question to try to rig up systems with some sort of non-abelian symmetry respecting these type of things. I haven't seen something written down yet. But as a sort of formal theoretical question, I think it's quite interesting to achieve that.
Strangely, are you going to care whether your non-relativistic systems arises limits of relativistic systems or not?
So they in a certain sense, there will be some sort of reductions. There won't be sort of contractions. But we'll see in more precise sense as I go along.
What are the scaling dimensions?
Sorry?
Scaling dimensions?
Okay, so in this system, this system is supposed to give you... the fermionic field in the system has canonical scaling dimension. There's two fermion bound state which has a large anomalous dimension at the fixed point.
Which can be measured?
Indirectly, perhaps. I don't know if it can be measured directly.
That's
why it's really strong. So I'll give you what the indicators of strong coupling are now. So this could have been sort of your run-of-the-mill free field theory. So what are the indicators of strong coupling? So this is another system that gives you a nearly ideal fluid. Okay, so here, the best case value I've seen quoted in literature for eta over s is roughly about 1 over pi. It's about 4 times bigger than the bound, but that's one indicator of strong coupling in the system. The other indicator of the system is that the energy per particle is about 50% of... free fermion value. So this indicator is, you should compare this to sort of pressure in the quark gluon plasma, normalized to the Stefan Boltzmann value, just about the confinement. So this is like our three quarters. So these are the two indicators that they have in the system that is strongly coupled. There's sort of other interesting physics in this system. So if you don't tune the space scattering lengths to infinity, on either side of this, on one side of this you have some sort of Bose-Einstein condensate. On another side you have a fermionic superfluid. So this system sort of behaves as some sort of transition crossover point at unitarity between a sort of fermionic superfluid and a case where the Cooper pairs are much more tightly bound and condensed into a superconductor. So there's a sort of interesting dynamics there, but we'll only explore the physics at this fixed point where I'm going to assume that this fixed point, by virtue of being scale invariant, is also conformally invariant. So I'm going to talk now about conformally invariant non-relativistic systems and then somehow try to engineer them in string theory.
Is there any system that sort of comes to you from nature that you don't just make in a lab for this purpose with these features?
With this? Well,
I mean, you know, you're sort of making this to order in a lab.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that most other sort of, I mean, the obvious thing you could have tried is helium-3, which is a fermionic superfluid at low temperatures. But there, I think that you don't see any of these other interesting phases. You don't have this tuning. So here, what you do is you sort of take, because you take these fermionic systems, you put them in some sort of optical trap, and then you start tuning the interaction length by hand, by sort of turning on some external magnetic fields, so that you achieve this conformal point. So in some sense, it's a fine-tuned conformal point. So it's not clear that there are other systems in nature that naturally sit there. Yes, Martin?
There's some simple Lagrangian you can write for the system.
I can write a simple Lagrangian. It's just some two-state fermionic system. And let me not spin by sigma. Gradient terms, and then a four Fermi coupling, which I'm going to fine tune. This coupling needs to be fine tuned.
These psi are the lithium atoms?
The psi are the lithium atoms. And the up and down refer to the two states in the lithium atom. So they
are. How many dimensions?
In real world, 3+1. well, in my universe, strange enough, it'll be 2+1. So
it can be 1, 2, 3.
Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. You say you by tuning the magnetic field, you fine tune the G.
Yeah, you fine tune G. Yeah.
How's the interaction between fermions fine tuned by magnetic?
Well, the thing is that what the magnetic field does, so you think of these two states as two hyperfine states of the lithium atom. And what the fine tuning does is sort of tune for you, it puts you on resonance, it gives you a new bound state, a threshold.
And is it true you don't have special conformal transformation in these systems? You just have scale?
Okay. So this is a usual game. Now, if you have a unitary theory with scale invariance, you can assume that, well, you can try to argue that the scale invariance actually promoted a full conformal invariance. So that's an assumption that's being made here. If I had just scale invariance, then you're right, I want a special conformal generators. But with full conformal invariance, I will have special conformal generators.
If I'm just naive, that interaction is irrelevant, isn't it, right? And what really is going on is things are happening at the scale of the cutoff that are being tuned given the velocity.
That's right.
So right. So I can't just look at this and say I've got normalization.
That's right. Yeah. So I think this particular model is more suited to 2+ epsilon dimensions. You get a fixed point at order epsilon. There is another model you can write down with sort of scalars, which you integrate out, which is better for 3 minus epsilon. Okay, so that's mostly what I wanted to say about the sort of experimental context. And I'll disclaim myself. Whatever I say henceforth, apart from the symmetries, you can take with a grain of salt. I'm not going to claim that I've written down a holographic dual for this particular system.
So
yeah.
When you say the system is slightly strongly coupled, do you mean that you can't solve it?
Or well,
just a bunch of atoms that you can solve every question we like?
Well, yeah, you can do lattice Monte Carlo on this. But I don't know if it's not perturbative.
You can't solve it by hand.
Well, because the fixed point is, as Joe said, the physics at the cutoff scale.
Could it possibly be relevant that matrix theory also has bound states of threshold? I mean, does this come up at all?
Not directly. Not directly. It's true, but there you end up with either a quantum mechanics system.
Yeah.
But
would that be interesting interpretation of being?
Well, in some sense, yes, right? Because if you're doing DLCQ, which is to some extent what I will be doing in a while, you are going to see something similar.
Very good.
Okay.
So the temperature does not play any role in this.
Well, so this is the story of the ground state. Then there's some finite temperature physics. There's some complicated phase diagram which I'm not drawing for you in the system. So at high temperatures, this theory will just be free fermions. Mm-hmm. But this is sort of low temperature dynamics where it shows something interesting.
The scale of the temperature is much lower than that of the energy?
For what I'm quoting, yes. Okay, so.
Can I suppose that the energy goes back 1/2 g/m².
Not sure. I'll have to check. So let's for now believe that this system realizes for us in some way a non-relativistic conformal field theory. And let's just ask what the symmetry algebra for a non-relativistic conformal field theory is. So this goes by the name of the Schrodinger algebra, which is the symmetry algebra that commutes with the free Schrodinger operator. Okay? So instead of describing it that way, let me give you a quick way to derive this algebra. So we all know that light cone reduction lets you go down from Poincaré or Lorentz symmetry down to a Galilean symmetry. Okay? So I'm going to be a bit perverse. I'm going to denote D by number of spatial dimensions. Okay? So here, if I start with SOD plus 1, 1, I can get Galilean algebra in D spatial dimensions. And this is just a symmetry algebra transverse to a light cone. And let me denote my light cone coordinates as x plus minus, and c plus minus some direction I pick, call that y. Okay. And so we know how this works. We've seen this work many times in sort of light cone string theory and so on. But nothing prevents me from in doing this for the conformal algebra. And if I did this reduction, I end up with the Schrodinger algebra. Okay, I'll be a bit more precise what I mean by here. And I'll call the algebra in D spatial dimensions Schrodinger D. So what do I keep? I keep all the generators of the conformal algebra that commute with the light cone momentum P minus. Minus is like a central term in this algebra. It commutes with everything. And so you basically have spatial rotations. I'll write down the algebra here, or at least the generators. So I keep all the spatial rotations. Translations. And the Galilean boost in the spatial directions. I have a Hamiltonian, which would now correspond to P plus. Sorry, rotations. keep a dilatation generator, which is some linear combination of the relativistic dilatation generator and M plus minus. And here, I get to keep one special conformal generator called C, which is just the boost in the light cone direction. Okay, so I don't get to keep this spatial conformal generator. I get to keep only the light cone generator, and I will call the light cone momentum P minus as particle number. So it's easy enough to write down the algebra, so I won't do that here. But I'll write down a couple of things which are interesting. So the most interesting thing here is that under dilatations, the Hamiltonian has weight 2. So in the conformal algebra, the Hamiltonian has weight 1. Whereas in the non-relativistic Schrodinger algebra, the Hamiltonian has weight 2.
Sorry, that H is this P plus?
That H is this P plus.
And that D is this P plus M plus minus.
Sorry. that D is this D.
That's just energy is momentum squared, right?
That's right. That's right. And there's an SL2R hidden here if I write down a combination of HC and D. Which I'll use later to sort of talk about some sort of state operator correspondence for the system. And as Eva just said, the fact that Hamiltonian has weight 2 is just the usual non-relativistic scaling, the time scales twice as fast as spatial distances. Hamiltonian is P squared. Okay?
P
minus commutes with everything. P minus commutes with everything. The only place it shows up in the algebra is in the commutator of Ki and Pi. Ki and Pi is a central term, which is P minus. Okay?
Does this mean that the H and D are not bounded from below?
No, you can write down spec representations which are bounded from below. I have negative eigenvalues. Did I screw up? Okay, I'm on. Don't count on my science. Okay. There's an obvious generalization that we can do here. Once I sort of start allowing anisotropic space-time scaling, I can consider more general scalings. But I scale time much faster than the spatial coordinates by some parameter nu. People tend to call 1 plus nu z as some critical exponent. I will refrain from using z. I'll just call nu this way. In this case, you only have a scaling symmetry. You don't have a full conformal algebra. The special conformal generator only exists for the case nu equals 1. So when you extend the scaling, first of all, P minus stops being central. It picks up a non-trivial dilatation weight, and you lose C from the algebra. Okay. So, for either of these, for the Schrodinger algebra, you can easily write down some sort of highest weight representations, as you would usually do for the conformal algebra. You pick states, you pick operators which are annihilated by C, which lowers the eigenvalue, and Ki, which also lowers the dilatation eigenvalue, and write down primary operators. The primary operators will carry a non-zero dilatation eigenvalue, but also some non-zero particle number, because I have to, since P minus commutes with everything, I can pick a definite eigenvalue for P minus and give every operator its P minus eigenvalue, which I'll call N. Okay? It turns out that if you try to ask for what constraints the algebra puts on correlation functions, it's much weaker than the corresponding relativistic conformal algebra. So you can look at, so let's say this is an operator O, which is specified by conformal dimension and its particle number. If I look at endpoint functions, you have an obvious super selection rule that sum of particle numbers has to vanish. But apart from that, the only correlation function that's constrained for primary operators is a two-point function. So and the form of the two-point function you can work out from the constraints. It has the right scaling. And has a heat kernel type behavior, which is characteristic of non-relativistic systems. Okay. Three-point functions are not constrained by the algebra. They're determined up to one unknown function of an invariant you can write down in terms of the length. So that's basically mostly what I wanted to say about the algebra. So now it's a good time. Is there any questions about it? Well, that some of these are creation and some of these are annihilation operators.
Are you going to relate this as to some sort of contraction? I mean, coming back to Aaron's question, contraction of the original conformal relativistic dynamics, and if so, does this have an interpretation in terms of? I mean, I'm thinking that in the standard Poincaré example we just started, you can move around between infinite momentum frame physics and the LCQ formulation. Is there a similar story?
Okay, so let me make one technical point. Uh-huh. This algebra is better thought of as a light cone reduction. It's not a contraction of the algebra. Okay, I use generators in going from the conformal algebra down here.
Okay.
In particular, I've lost the special conformal generators. So it has fewer generators than the parent. So it's not a contraction. There, however, is a contraction of the conformal algebra. Okay, but by contraction, I really mean you take the conformal algebra and send speed of light to infinity. Okay. There is a contraction of the algebra which goes by the name of what's called a Galilean conformal algebra, as opposed to the Schrodinger algebra. That guy works differently. In particular, there the Hamiltonian has weight 1, not weight 2, under dilatations. There's an attempt to try to define holography for the Galilean conformal algebra. As far as I know, there is no metric theory of gravity which is holographically dual to. There is some Newton-Cartan theory which has been posited as the holographic dual.
So sorry, could you explain again this exponential phase of the 2.0?
Well, this comes from a Ward identity. You can write down the conformal Ward identity and check that this is satisfied. But what I'm, my throwaway remark was just that x squared over 2t is characteristic of sort of diffusive heat kernel type behavior, which is canonical in non-relativistic systems first order, which have first order equations in time. I've committed here to z equals to. I haven't tried working out what the story is for higher z. Yeah, or my notation u equals one. Yeah.
Sorry. So what's the rationale for putting the sum of the n's to zero?
That's a super selection rule.
Oh, it's just.
Okay. Right. So.
Is there a solvable system with some set of scaling dimensions?
I will give you one model. You can tell me whether it's solvable or not. Okay. So now let me try to motivate holography for these spacetimes, and I'm going to follow the paths taken by Damson and Balasubramaniam and McGreevy in their paper from about a year ago in trying to realize. They were mostly interested in realizing the case z equals 2 or nu equals 1. And I'll also mention simultaneously a different interpretation for non-trivial z by Shamit and friends, where they also gave a class of spacetimes which have some similar holographic duals. So let's take a sort of first, before I go there, let me take a very simple-minded perspective. Okay, what I want to realize is this type of scaling symmetry in a holographic dual. Okay, so how am I going to do that? So let me start by writing down everybody's favorite geometry, ADS3. Reasons will become clear later why I'm in ADS3. But let me write ADS3 in Poincaré coordinates. And pick light cone coordinates on the volume directions. Okay, I've taken ADS3 because I want these spatial directions, and then I want a light cone, and I have to have an extra radial direction to make up the ADS. Now, the canonical scaling, if I were to do ADS CFT here, is that we would scale all the volume coordinates democratically and we scale the radius with 1 over that scale. Okay? And this would give us back the usual scaling for a relativistic conformal field theory. But having written it in light cone coordinates, I don't have to pick this canonical scaling. The following scaling would also work. I'm free to pick this. I haven't done anything. I've just taken ADS, and I've decided that I'm going to scale my generators differently. OK, so I've realized the scaling. But the question is this theory really non-relativistic? Well, I could try to make it non-relativistic by doing DLCQ, by compactifying x minus. Then I would be doing DLCQ in ADS. We know that transverse to the light cone, I would still have the Galilean symmetry. But since I've picked non-trivial scaling for my time coordinate, I would not only get the Galilean symmetry, but I would get some sort of anisotropic space-time scaling in my Galilean field theory. But this is just a perverse way of quantizing a relativistic field theory. If I kept track of all my zero modes, I would realize that my theory deep down has relativistic scaling invariance. and the vacuum state would have the full relativistic conformal invariance. But nevertheless, this is one way to realize these type of scalings in ADS-CFT.
Sorry, if you really do DLCQ, do you actually compactify the X minus direction? Right. Doesn't it break that relativistic symmetry?
Well, you're worried about the fact that I can sort of boost these things?
You said that the theory was written as a secret relativistic symmetry.
Yes. Yes.
But if you really done DLCQ and you compactify X minus, it doesn't have that symmetry anymore, right?
Well, but if I did my physics right, if it's a DLCQ of a relativistic field theory, at the end of the day, I should recover back the correct physics, which was that of a relativistic conformal field theory.
If nu is 1,
yes,
then there's no problem. Yes. Right? Then X minus doesn't get rescaled, so you can compactify it with some fixed size,
yes,
and everything is good. But you're saying that even if nu is not 1, it makes sense to...
I think so, yeah.
Confused by the same question.
Okay, so we'll see in a while that even for nu equals 1, it will be a slightly degenerate case. Because there's yet another symmetry here. There's a boost symmetry here in x plus x minus, where I can rescale x plus up and x minus down.
You use that, so it needs to be
right? No.
Isn't that preservation just a combination of a boost with the first preservation?
This one is, yes. That's right. Okay, so I think that if you get the zero mode physics right in the DLCQ, you should see the correct physics of the relativistic vacuum. I don't see how it can be otherwise. I haven't done anything to the field theory. Right? I've just chosen to quantize it differently.
You affine parameter along the x minus direction? So you can get your energy and all kinds of effects right there.
You have to take a limit where the number of units of light cone momentum in the compact direction is very large. That's how you get back to the relativistic theory, isn't it?
That's true, yes. So you say in any fixed momentum sector, I won't see the full relativistic symmetry. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that I agree with. Okay.
So if there's more general symmetry, do you realize in terms of some other discrete quantization, I mean some kind of application through an odd generator, not through the light cone generator, but through a combination of the light cone?
Not the light cone and some...
I can't picture it. It can also be realized.
Not that I know of. Not that I know of at the top of my head. Okay.
Are we talking about compactifying the x minus direction under this first scaling, or the second one for this case, nu equals, when nu is not 1? I'm still confused about Gary's point. I mean, if we compactify x minus, it looks like it breaks the symmetry you've written down as well.
Okay. So the case that I'm going to be most interested in is nu equals 1, in which case x minus doesn't have any scaling. Okay. But even for that case, I'm going to argue that this is not the right geometry in a moment.
Okay.
Okay? I'm going to do something to this geometry and call that the right geometry. And this is what I'm going to do. I just added one piece to my ADS metric, which was a G++ term with scale like R to the 2 nu. So this is the metric that Damson, John McGreevy, and John's student Kaushik Balasubramaniam wrote down. And here you see I don't have a choice. This is a scaling symmetry that this geometry needs to have to be scale invariant. Because of this R to the 2 nu term, I have to scale x plus with lambda to the power 1 plus nu, and then the x minus scaling is given by the x plus x minus term. Of course, this is not the only geometry I could have written down. I can also write down the geometry that Shamit and Zhao Liu and Mike Mulligan wrote down, which is a different variant, but I don't have a light cone, but I'm just scaling space and time anisotropically. Okay. So, apart from the scaling, so let me give these geometries then so I can refer to them later. I'm going to call this Schrodinger D plus 3 with some index nu, and I'll call this Lipschitz D plus 2 with an index nu. Okay? So, first of all, this guy has the isometry group being the full Schrodinger algebra in D spatial dimensions. Okay, so, nu equals 1 is the case that we're going to be most interested in. With this metric, that's going to be the case relevant for a non-relativistic conformal field theory. If you just wanted scaling invariance, you could work with this stuff, but if you want conformal invariance, this is the geometry that realizes the full conformal, non-relativistic conformal symmetry. Funnily enough, one other example has shown up in literature before, and that's what led us to construct these geometries in string theory. Nu equals 2 in so here it's in 5 dimensions is a dual light-like non-commutative super Young mills theory. Okay, so you take n equals 4 super Young mills and you add a light-like non-commutativity, and you ask what the holographic dual is. The holographic dual is this space-time with nu equals 2. So, of course, I haven't written down the sources, what sources this metric. Both of these are not just sourced by cosmological constant. I need some extra matter to satisfy the field equations. So I'll come back to what the matter is. So originally, when these geometries were proposed, this space-time was supported by a massive vector field. So gravity plus negative cosmological constant plus a massive vector had this geometry as a solution. This guy requires a combination of a vector field and a two-form potential with some particularly chosen Chern-Simons coupling to find this metric as a solution. Okay, so I'll give you my favorite reason for why this class of spacetimes should be taken seriously, and in fact why they should be thought of as holographic duals for a non-relativistic field theory. And this has something to do with their causal structure. Maybe I should remark before I go for causal structure. These spacetimes for nu equals 1, you can show are regular. They're juristically complete. the regular on the Poincaré horizon. This spacetime, on the other hand, is not regular on the Poincaré horizon. Well, r equals 0 would have been the Poincaré horizon, but this term falls off too fast, and this spacetime has diverging tidal forces on the Poincaré horizon. It's not the case with the previous guy. But
so some scalar quantity blows up at r equals 0?
No, well, you can show that scalar curvature invariants are all finite. They're well behaved. So curvature components in some parallel transported flame blow up. So geodesic observers would see large tidal forces.
Okay.
So it's not directly seen in curvature components. So curvature invariants would be well behaved. And in this case, it's much cleaner. This is a null deformation of ADS. So all curvature invariants are identical to what they were in the ADS spacetime.
This is in the case where X minus is not compact.
Well, okay. So for now, X minus is not compact.
Yeah.
The point I want to make is that even when X minus is non-compact, the causal structure of this Schrodinger spacetime is not just compatible with non-relativistic field theories. It's actually something I think is quite natural for non-relativistic field theories, in that this spacetime has a non-distinguishing causal structure, which I'll explain in a moment. So what do I mean by this? So we have a non-relativistic field theory, and we want to construct some sort of holographic dual for this non-relativistic field theory. So we simultaneously want something where, in the field theory, action at a distance is allowed. So if I have a perturbation at some instant of time, it can propagate arbitrarily long spatial distances in infinitesimal amount of time. But at the same time, I seem to be wanting to demand that I have a holographic dual with a nice Lorentzian tangent space. Okay? So this at first sight sounds odd. So it doesn't sound like these two things should go hand in hand. And this spacetime sort of overcomes that problem very, very nicely. So how does it do that? So the simplest way I can describe this is to draw for you So let's consider a plane of constant x plus in the space-time. Okay. And ask what the causal future of a point P, which has some coordinates, ask what this causal future is. Okay. Now, the answer is actually quite startling. The answer is that every point above this plane is in the causal future of this point. Single point P, it's true for all points on this plane. So every point on this plane has an identical causal future, which is everything above this plane. Okay, so above is that way. So this is sort of x plus qualified condition of. So this is not a conventional causal space-time. In fact, it's barely causal. Okay. So it's causal in the sense that you don't have any close time-like or close null curves, but it violates every other non-causality condition. But certainly not globally hyperbolic. Yeah, not by long shot. The point here is that it, to even sort of define some sort of meaningful notion using causal sets for manifold topology, you'd want to sort of be able to distinguish points based on their causal futures. So here, because there's more than one point which has the same causal future, I can't use the causal sets to distinguish points, and hence non-distinguishing.
So this presumably depends crucially on the asymptotic.
Indeed, exactly.
If you cut off the space at some large finite radius, this all goes away.
Okay, so this is a very interesting question. So I should say how do we know that the spacetime is non-distinguishing? So it's not. So the geodesics in the spacetime are well behaved. They won't get you anywhere. What you can do is you can start at P, and then you can find causal curves that will sort of, as you say, go to arbitrarily long distance. In particular, exploit the fact that at large r, this term is highly time-like. So you exploit that fact, and then sort of do a long loop, and end up arbitrarily close to where you started. Now, how close to where you started depends on how far you can go out. So if I cut off the spacetime, indeed, I can't come arbitrarily close. I can come a fixed distance, somehow depending on the cutoff. There's an interesting sort of UV-IR correspondence here, but we don't fully know what the precise map is, because it's all sort of given to you in terms of causal curve, so you have a bunch of inequalities, which you have to sort of optimize. So you need to know what's the best path in the space of causal curves to get you closest with a given sort of cutoff in the radial direction. So a related question is, how do you define asymptopia for these kind of geometries? That's a question that I won't perhaps get time to answer here. But I find it natural that the bulk spacetime, despite having a nice Lorentzian tangent space, nevertheless has a causal structure that's commensurate with the Galilean field theory. So it sort of makes it natural for the field theory to have this spacetime as a dual.
This is true as long as what? Nu is bigger than 1?
As long as nu is bigger than 1. Any nu bigger than 1, this is true.
What about nu equals 1?
Nu equals 1 also, it's true. So nu greater than equals 1 is not distinct. Okay, so one more technical remark here is that for these spacetimes can be realized as coset spaces. So this is a metric on a particular coset of the Schrodinger group. This was discussed not long ago by Shafer Nameki, Yoshida, who was here, and Yamazaki in a nice paper. So in some sense, this is the nice analog of ADS for spacetimes with the Galilean conformal algebra. Okay. So now I want to move on and try to put this into string theory and see what we get. So we've sort of started out by saying we have some algebra. We want to sort of realize some spacetime that realizes this algebra. Wrote down a metric without saying where it came from, and saw that at least it has the right qualitative features to describe a field theory with the symmetries that I want. Okay. So then the clue for us was the fact that we knew where we could get a particular case as in terms of light-like non-commutative Young Mills. So there were three papers in last summer trying to embed these this class of geometries in string theory. This class, as far as I know, has not been still embedded, although various people are thinking about how to embed these Lipschitz spacetimes into string theory. Okay, so how do we do this? So it actually turns out to be very, very simple. So this was done by Malasena, Martelli, and Tachikawa, Adams, Balasubramaniam, and McGreevy, Simon Ross, Chris Herzog, and myself. And the trick is very easy. There is a duality transform which different people like to call them different things. We like to call it null Melvin twist. Or you can call it a TSC transformation. All of these things, all they do is take, let's pick a particular example. Let's take ADS5 times some internal space on Feynman manifolds on Sosak-Einstein. They will take you from here to perhaps warped. What precisely do these dualities do? Well, these dualities are engineered to add null NSNSB flux. The TSC transformation is much simpler to describe. So I pick some isometry, U1 isometry in this compact space. I trivialize along that isometry. I shift the light cone direction x minus along the U1 fiber, and then trivialize back along the same U1 direction to get here. Okay? So you can get the space time I've written there, but let me write it out for the particular case of ADS5 for nu equals 1. I have some phi form flux, which is the usual related to the volume form on S5, and then there is a B field, which is okay. So in writing this, I have written the B field as some sort of it's a null B field which has component along the fiber direction. I have written S5 in a particular Hopf fibration over CP2. So the B field is pointing along the fiber. And it's this B field when reduced on the S5 that leads to a massive vector. So if I take this solution in 10 dimensions and reduce down to 5 dimensions, I'm going to get a massive vector that points in X plus. The B field gives me a massive vector. And in general, I could have some scalars. For this particular solution, the S5 is not deformed, so I don't get any scalars.
This is a result of your transformation?
This is the result of our transformation.
But that's, you meant to have the minus beta b squared?
Oh, sorry, I said beta to 1, but...
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah. You assume anything on the Sasaki-Einstein?
One U1. Only one U1 isometry. So any Sasaki-Einstein meter, at least just one, would do. Yeah.
How about the homologically non-trivial cycle?
Well, I need to be able to do a T-duality. But
is there a three-cycle?
I don't need a three-cycle for this. No, because this is pointing in the fiber and the X plus direction. Mm-hmm. And the phi form is not deformed, so I don't need a three-cycle.
So you want the SQ to be compact?
I want the isometry to be compact.
It has to be regular.
What's curious about this class of solutions is that they lead to something interesting in supergravity, which was pointed out by Maldacena and friends, is that there is a consistent truncation of 2B supergravity to 5 dimensions, which is whose bosonic components are given by metric plus a massive vector plus three scalars. So we're all used to consistent truncations, which are sort of gauge supergravities, where you only keep massless modes. This is a new kind of consistent truncation where you keep only the metric, which is the massless mode. Everything else is massive. In particular, the vector you get here is massive. And this seems to be a sort of one in a larger family of consistent truncations. They found two. They found one with a particular value of this mass, and the second one where there was a massless, where there was no B field, but just pure phi form compactification. And a couple more now that have been discovered for M30 compactifications down to 4 dimensions with massive fields. So I've written for you a geometry. I told you I got this by duality. So now I should be able to answer the question, what is the field theory? And here's where you will see that this field theory that I'm going to describe is quite different from what I started out telling you about. So you can think of this space-time as a decoupling limit of D3 brains in a asymptotically null Melvin space-time. So if I did this transformation for flat space, I would end up with an asymptotically null Melvin spacetime. I would just have a B field. So I put some D3 brains and then decouple them. But this theory has been studied. Aaron and Ori Gonor studied this long time ago, and in fact, it's a non-local deformation of n equals 4. A so-called dipole deformation but for my purposes I'm going to describe this very prosaically as some sort of non-commutative field theory. So let's say F and G are some fields in n equals 4 in some n equals 1 multiplet language. Okay, I'm going to replace products of these fields by some sort of hybrid star product the star product I'm going to pick this let's step back a moment and ask what would happen if instead of doing this putting a B field in the null direction I put a purely spatial B field. Okay, on a D3 brain. Then I'd end up with a non-commutative field theory, and the star product I would have involve spatial momenta. Okay. Here, the star product I have involves the light cone momentum P minus and the R charge along this U1 fiber that I've picked. So X had a U1, and that particular R charge is what I'm picking. So this is some sort of deformation that involves both the volume directions and the transverse space to construct something non-local. But it doesn't hide the fact that this theory started out with non-abelian gauge symmetry, so it's just some deformed non-abelian gauge theory. Doesn't a priori have anything to do with fermions at unitarity. Okay? But this way of thinking about it also makes certain things clear. because it's a non-commutative class of deformations, at large n, if I'm working in a if I'm working with a gauge group, which is whose rank is going to infinity, then at tree level, all the physical quantities of this deformed theory will agree with the undeformed theory. Okay, so there's a large inheritance principle here. Protecting the tree level results. So this will be useful for some of the things I'll say as a cross-check of various things. Okay. So that's the string theory realization of field theories which have these Galilean distorted algebra. And now, I'll pause to take questions before moving on to discussing some other aspects of these theories.
So, I mean, the theories that Rory and I looked at with the spatial dipoles are sort of very badly behaved curvatively. I think they start getting more and more non-local. I mean, this
right.
thing.
Well, okay, so there's something certainly strange about them because the asymptotics is very weird. But my intuition is more governed by this light-like non-commutative Young-Mills, which we know is a well-behaved field theory. So I would expect this thing to be pretty much similar. But I don't think anybody has sort of looked at this deformation, this particular null deformation in detail in field theory.
I mean, the original non-commutative Young-Mills theory had these weird sort of extra,
Well, I mean, there's some non-trivial UVIR type relations, and you will see those here as well. But the point is that if you're looking at planar quantities, you're not going to see any of those. And since we're doing supergravity, we are in the planar limit, and you're not going to see any such thing feature.
So what is the inheritance principle? It's the leading order in large N, it's the same as the undeformed?
Undeformed theory.
Undeformed N equals 4.
Undeformed N equals 4.
On just flat space.
On flat space, yes.
Then at leading order, it would recover the full conformal variance of that theory.
Well, the correlation functions would have some sort of structure, which would be inherited. But then you have to ask yourself, okay, so this is all true before I sort of compact, if x minus is not compact.
Uh-huh.
So now if I want to compactify x minus, then I'm and sort of work in a sector with fixed particle number, then I'm going to have to Fourier transform these results. And that would give me the results relevant for the Galilean theory. But the point is that you don't have to do a new calculation. You can take the results you already know and re-massage them into this theory. So this has been checked for various. So correlation functions have been checked. And what I'm about to say about thermodynamics, this would also be true.
Sorry? Is it obvious that this theory has non-relativistic
invariance?
Sorry? Is it obvious that that theory has
non-relativistic? Picking a particular P minus momentum is breaking the symmetry along, and so I'm the only symmetries I have left are symmetries which commute P minus, which is how I define the Schrodinger algebra in the first place.
Special value of the shifted equivalent theory.
Right.
So for which value of parameters you have?
Well, but you're thinking of spatial TSTs, right? You're thinking of beta deformations inside the S5. But this is a bit more weird, right? Because it involves...
Suppose you compactify X plus.
X minus. Well, then I would say I should get a Galilean theory. I should never get equal. I mean, then I pick compactify X minus and pick a sector with definite particle number, so definite P minus momentum. Then you take your correlation functions and Fourier transform them with respect to...
Yes, so it breaks symmetry in some truncation of string theory, but in the whole string theory on the spectrum, you'll have still the same symmetry.
Well,
that's
not clear to me. I mean, the sigma model on this space is going to be very different from the sigma model on ADS5.
If it's related by TST, it will be related.
So you said the full string spectrum will be related to the...
Yeah, with certain identifications, it comes, yeah. It just ordinary TTL, it just depends how you do it.
Right.
Don't you at some point do a boost, right? I thought that what you do is you kind of say that if the circle was non-compact, then you boost, but since it's compact, it's no longer a symmetry, so it's not really a duality anymore.
Yes.
It's so more of a solution generating.
Yeah. That was asking the value of parameter matters, of course.
But that
breaks the...
But I would say the only parameter for which, well, okay, so I had to think about it, but I would have said the only parameter value for which you get record equivalence is beta equals zero, which is clearly pure radius.
Yeah, if it's minus
with
compact, then we'll have an extra.
Then I'll have a scale. So.
So this field theory is a 3+1 field theory, but somehow this deformation, I mean, it affects the UV physics.
That's right.
In that theory. So,
yes.
I mean, is it renormalizable? I mean, what's the right?
Okay, so I would say it's, it would be as renormalizable as any of these non-commutative field theories. So
what's the supersymmetry?
Okay, so this TST breaks all supersymmetry. This geometry doesn't have any killing spinners.
But in the non-commutative field, you can deform some supersymmetry generators.
So in this case, we have 16 supergenerators. In this particular case, there aren't any. There aren't any.
Is it lack of imagination?
No, it's just you look for killing spinners in this geometry. There aren't any which solve the killing spinner equation.
So at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that just ordinary ADS and null coordinates could be viewed as having the symmetry, the scaling that you want. Now, does the inheritance principle say that you could have actually
used
that geometry with X minus?
Precisely. Because it's a very particular non-commutative type deformation, yeah. If I want answers for questions that are leading order in large N, mm-hmm. I could have used ADS and got those answers.
You're not really testing this geometry with non-zero beta.
That's right. So if I want to really test the geometry, then I'd have to ask questions which involve 1/n physics. So a question that we could test, or something you could have thought would give you some insight, is to do thermodynamics or hydrodynamics, but you can now guess what the answers are going to be. So because we got these geometries by some sort of duality transformation, and we know how to embed them in string theory, it's trivial to start from a geometry which is thermal and construct black hole solutions which asymptote to this geometry. I won't write down the metric, it is not very illuminating, is that you can think of these black hole solutions you get correspond to a particular, this non-relativistic CFT in a grand canonical ensemble. At some fixed temperature and chemical potential for p minus momentum, which is particle law. Okay. And once you have the black hole solution, you can do various ways to calculate the on-shell action. Again, there are lots of technicalities there, which I'm sweeping under the rug. And recover the thermodynamics, but the thermodynamics is pretty benign. The most interesting result you can get is the equation of state. So if you had relativistic conformal invariance, the equation of state was energy was 3 times pressure, say in 4 dimensions. If you have a non-relativistic CFT, here I started with a 4-dimensional n equals 4 Supiang-Mills, and I pick the sector with particular p minus. So the spatial dimensions in which my field theory is living is two spatial dimensional. And I need to recover, if the thermodynamics corresponds to that for a non-relativistic theory, I need to recover from the black hole solution an equation of state that's consistent with non-relativistic scaling invariance. The equation of state which does that, you can convince yourself, is E equals PV. The simplest way to think about this is there is a much simpler system that has non-relativistic conformal invariance, which is just ideal gas in two spatial dimensions. In two spatial dimensions, the equation of state is E equals PV. And this works out from the black hole computation. So this is a computation that you need to do, but it's a check that the black hole solution we had does indeed give the right thermodynamics. In general, in these spatial dimensions, you can check that the energy density as a function of temperature and chemical potential has to scale as you have the following scaling law. This just follows from an analog of tracelessness of stress tensor for this non-relativistic algebra. And this would give you an equation of state. Which again, you can check by writing down appropriate black hole solutions. But there's something already here with this function that you can tell that these theories are not behaving similar to the cold atom systems in the lab. So for example, this function g of x has a power law behavior. Let me give you the answer in one particular example. So for large x, for small x, it behaves like x to the 5/2 when derived from supergravity. For the real world cold atom systems, this function goes to constant. It doesn't have this divergence at small x. So these are sort of systems which have this class of with this kind of this Galilean conformal symmetry, but are very different from the systems we would like to apply this duality. What is similar, and I'll quickly give you the answer and stop, is certain characteristics of hydrodynamics. So once you have a black hole solution, you can't stop yourself. You have to ask, what is the ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density? So, don't think anybody gets prizes for guessing. It's 1/4 pi. In fact, this computation is very strange. The black hole solution I described is a solution to a complicated theory. There's massive vectors, there's scalars, and all modes of the graviton fluctuation are coupled. The only mode which is not coupled for symmetry reasons is the shear mode. The wave equation for the shear mode of the graviton is identical to the wave equation in pure ADS up to a scaling. And there's an old argument due to Gary and Dean Wells that entropy doesn't change under duality transformations. So putting those two together, you can easily conclude that this had to be true. The one other...
So now this is true for a non-relativistic...
If it's true for the non-relativistic theory that you can engineer from string theory, yeah. Now, whether you want to take this and apply this to cold atom systems in light of everything else I've said, is up to you. The only one other thermodynamic quantity which you can, a couple of other hydrodynamic quantities you can extract, you can show that the bulk viscosity vanishes. This follows from the scale invariance. And one other fun quantity you can calculate, which we did, is the ratio of thermal conductivity to shear viscosity, rather some rescale quantities. So let me tell you what the thermal conductivity is. The thermal conductivity itself is because of the system, in some sense, comes from some parent relativistic theorem. The thermal conductivity is proportional to shear viscosity. There's some thermodynamic quantities here, energy and particle density. But a better measure is the ratio of sort of momentum diffusion to thermal diffusion, measured by the so-called Prandtl number, which is another dimensionless ratio you can construct. And this guy, for these theories, you can show is identically one. This follows again from, if you like, from some sort of inheritance principle. You can start with a relativistic hydrodynamic system, light cone reduce it, and read off these answers. And just to give you some comparison, something like Mercury would have a Prandtl number of 10 to the minus 3 because it's much slower diffuser of momentum than heat. Okay, so there's this class of geometries that have realization in string theory and seem to realize this Galilean conformal algebra. There's a lot more to understand about them. In particular, one of the things I haven't talked about and something which is very confusing is how to define asymptotics here, how to actually work with these spacetimes in detail. So we have some partial progress in trying to compute the thermodynamics, but we don't have a full story. In my mind, one of the interesting things to come out of this analysis is perhaps a positive answer to the following question. You could ask, are spacetimes that have weird causal structures, should they be admissible in a honest quantum theory of gravity? Okay, so in particular, if your spacetime is just causal but doesn't satisfy any other causality constraints, should this be promoted in full quantum theory, or is it just an interesting classical solution to GR which we should forget about? And this exercise seems to suggest that perhaps we should take those various spacetimes seriously. Perhaps some class of them does indeed have a non-perturbative holographic description in terms of some dual theory. We don't understand the dual theories in these cases very well. They're still non-local field theories. But nevertheless, it's suggestive that there's something interesting going on here.
Is there any reason to think that an exotic causal structure would be problematic?
Well, okay, so I can give you one naive argument to say an exotic causal structure would be problematic. So when people describe various sort of causality conditions, you could have said that maybe it's global hyperbolicity is not a requirement, but it at least want the spacetime to be what's called stably causal. And a simple reason is that under quantum fluctuations, you don't want your light cone to open out so much that you induced causality violation. Okay, so this is an argument that could have been given for stable causality as a criterion for spacetimes being good in quantum gravity. This spacetime is far from achieving anything close to stable causality. In particular, what stable causality wants you to do is not open out the light cones arbitrarily so you have closed time like curves, but here the light cone is opened out as much as it can be. You have thought that quantum fluctuations just make it worse.
Do you know what happens to
the
causal structure if you
have
normalizable perturbations in
there? Okay, so the trick here is that somehow it's all tight asymptotics, right? I'm not allowed to fill the asymptotics because that's governed by the field theory. and that's what sort of freezes the causal structure to be no worse than the non-relativistic causal structure. In light of that, it's perhaps not surprising, but it's nevertheless an indication that.
It all makes sense. I mean, there were various comments about is this a renormalizable theory?
Yes.
You said a little worse than those in there and so forth. So has anyone actually calculated the normalizable perturbations in this space time and seen how fast they fall, what they do to the causal structure? That would be one way of checking that, in fact, the picture really is consistent. I mean, one expects that normalizability causes the...
Yeah, so I mean, if you play with sort of standard set of scalars or whatever, the normalizable modes do not deform the... are such that they don't modify the asymptotics. They leave the causal structure unchanged. So that, but whether this is true for all possible fluctuations?
It's true for the tensor.
Okay, nobody has done that. Okay, I think I should stop there.
Thank you very much. Are we running out?